Welcome to High Noon, where we talk about controversial subjects with interesting people. So glad to have Maddie Kearns back on the program over from her position as a staff writer at National Review. As if you're watching the video, you can see she's in the office. She's also a fellow with us at IW. So welcome back, Maddie.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to talk today about a few things, but starting with the longer thing that we call policy focus over at policy foci. I've always insisted for the foci pluralism, but that just sounds so stupid when I say it out loud. But these are our longer policy sort of explanatory documents over at IW. And you've written a really great one about basically the landscape, both from the medical sort of organizations and what the states have done about minor gender transition. So first of all, what is the landscape now as opposed to, let's say, 3 or 5 years ago? Because I feel like this fight burst into the mainstream over gender ideology and really picked up steam. And it was something, fortunately, that we saw a lot of support from the middle on. There were a lot of people who are moderate or even liberal who agreed with conservatives that this was horrifying, that these sort of medical experimentation on children with the goal, the quixotic goal of trying to change their sex, and unfortunately many side effects to that effect, was not a good thing. And so we had states pushing back and so what does the landscape now look like legally in the United States? And what is it like sort of between the medical organizations and the federal government on the one hand and then the states on the other?
Yeah, so I think 5 years ago, we were really at a place with this where the changes were all happening by stealth and they were happening on the trans activist side. So this was not something that was commonly talked about. You could suggest that this was going on to politicians and they would, like Republican politicians, and sort of stare at you blankly and say, I've not heard of that. What they're doing what? Who's doing this? This seems sort of fringe. And so you were having laws go sort of unnoticed in democratic states, these sort of monomaniacal trans activists who are pushing for things like conversion therapy bans so broadly defined to include the standard treatment for gender dysphoria, which is just a talk therapy where the patient or the patient's family and the person giving the therapy understands that the ideal outcome here, given that you can't change your sex, the ideal outcome is that this person comes to accept their body as it is. And of course, that was what was happening with the vast majority of these cases before we tried this so-called gender affirmation approach, which is a sort of one size fits all nuclear button, which starts with a social transition, then puberty blockers, then cross-sex hormones, and then finally surgeries to modify somebody's sex characteristics. That was sort of, this was all happening by stealth, and we were hearing stories. I remember from my early reporting 5 years ago, just absolute horror stories from parents who'd been completely caught off guard with this stuff. So one family whose 17-year-old had got into the transgender thing online, convinced herself that she was a boy, ran away to Oregon, where state law permitted her to have all these body modifications without parental consent, taxpayer funded. That was sort of unknown. I don't think most people were aware of what was going on. But that changed, of course. That changed because there was reporting on it, and it broke through. And it's not just happened in America, which I know we'll get onto later. And so what you had was a Republican reaction to that. And so they started passing laws. Republicans in red states started passing laws to stop these medical experiments, either puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, surgeries, all of the above, and also to sort of address some of the damage that had been done by trans activists in the law elsewhere. The progressive states that are really under the influence of these trans activists doubled down on their position. And so what you've really ended up with is this conflicting patchwork of legislation, not totally dissimilar to to another culture war issue like abortion, where you have very extreme on either side across the states. So you could go into one state and you could have, you know, the whole work's done, so-called sex change surgery. You could go into another state as a minor and you wouldn't be able to do that. So that's kind of where we're at with it, is that because of heightened public awareness and political pressure on Republicans to do something about this, you have a sort of prolonged state of contradiction.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering if any of that pressure, because it seems to me that this is actually a direct conflict in some ways between the power of quote-unquote experts, which tends to be softer, tends to be, a lot of it is through either bureaucracy when it's legal, and the school districts with policies about social transition are a really good example. Very few of those policies went through the school board, right? These are mm-hmm. not things that are done in the open sort of small d democratic light of day. These are things that are done in the diversity office of the district and then shuttled to all of the schools. And most parents don't actually know that the policy has changed, right? So a lot of the advancements for trans activists were done in that way. And some of the most powerful of those advancements have been not even government at all, but have been professional organizations, right? If you can say that the Pediatric Association or, you know, some kind of medical association approves of this kind of treatment, even for minors, that becomes the standard, the medical standard, right? And that matters for lawsuits, but it also matters for this kind of very heavy weight that we now place, which I think, you know, we should reconsider broadly, not just in this one area, but we now culturally place behind the so-called experts. And on the other hand, you have states that are applying very direct democratic political power, mm-hmm. right? These are extremely popular laws. They are passed on the state level through the legislature. There's a big fur about it. People testify. They yell at each other. And then there's a new law that takes place in that state. And yes, there are problems with crossing state lines. Like, this is a general federalism problem. But it makes me wonder which one of these forces is stronger in the long run, mm-hmm. right? Whether you'll see one side swamp the other over time. Like, in other words, will this sort of pushback in the states and codified pushback reach a point where we've got, you know, whatever it is, 35, 40 states, everything, but, you know, Vermont, you know, Washington, D.C., New York, and California or whatever, right? Because there are a lot of Democrats who believe in this. So I could at least theoretically imagine something like that happening. At what point does that start to outweigh the advice of some of these medical associations and the more informal power of experts, do you think?
Well, I think you're quite right to notice the distinction between those two arguments from authority. There's the just brute political force, and then there's the but the science says. But actually, the left is sort of losing, or not necessarily losing, but they're fighting a battle on both of those fronts, because again, 5 years ago, it was quite easy just to assert that these are the standards of care, because obviously in any other field of medicine, standards of care are established by consensus and in response to evidence. But what happened with this novel field of transgender pediatric medicine was that you didn't have the evidence base, and you certainly didn't have the consensus. So what you did was you influenced key political committees that represent large bodies. So, for example, the American Academy of Pediatrics is one, you know, Endocrine Society is another. And so what they did was they had the people who actually write the policy statements are you know, a small number of people. It's maybe like between 10 and 15 people, depending on the organization. And if you can just get one activist to come in, and by the way, the activists can also be clinicians, right? They're not necessarily people with no medical expertise, although in the case of the American Academy of Pediatrics, they did have influence from somebody with no medical training. And what you do is you have them write the policy statement, that gets approved by the 15 members. This is a this is an organization that represents hundreds of thousands of specialists, but it's 15 that decide it. And then when the New York Times or whoever it is starts to report on what are doctors saying about best practice for treating so-called transgender youth, they go to the American Academy of Pediatrics website, they see the policy statement, and they go, ah, see, there's your consensus. And there must be evidence because we trust this organization to do that. And of course, that's just not sustainable anymore as a line of argument, in part because it's been so challenged and so debated within the medical profession. Now, it used to be that any sort of alternative medical body that was set up to challenge this was sort of dismissed out of hand as right wing or Christian or whatever. But then what happened, of course, was that medical professionals in Europe, in secular enlightened Europe, with no religious or political affiliation, were saying the same things. We don't have the evidence to be doing this. This is not safe. We don't have established standards of care through evidence. There is not a consensus. This is high risk. This is experimental. And it's unacceptable, given that children can't give informed consent in the proper way. Also, that's just stuff that once you start drilling down is sort of just knowable by common sense. I mean, there's all sorts of things that children can't give informed consent to that are a lot less damaging than this. For instance, tattoos. And the American Academy of Pediatrics would have no issue sort of seeing that. So you're right. That was a debate that was really important to win. And I think the reason that I think that is a battle that they're now engaging on. They used to just ignore it and pretend it wasn't happening and it was only a right-wing conspiracy. But they can't really do that now, in part because of the global conversation within the medical profession. So the New York Times, for instance, has shifted. It has had to cover this and say, you know, in some ways, the United States is an outlier in its approach to transgender medicine. Which invites the question, could they be getting this wrong, even to your honest broker or your politically liberal reader of the New York Times could be wondering, we could be getting this horribly wrong. We've certainly gotten things wrong before. Now, obviously, in an ideal world, the medical profession would regulate itself. And for the most part, the medical profession does a fairly good job of regulating itself in terms of, you know, this is obviously a very litigious society and people can sue for malpractice. That hasn't worked here because, one, the standards of care aren't properly established, and two, there's all sorts of things related to statute of limitations that prevent people from that. Also, these people typically don't have, you know, a lot of resources. A lot of people will pay for these surgeries out of pocket. They don't have insurance. It's expensive to sue doctors and so on. But nevertheless, some have tried. But all of that conversation, that challenge to this assertion, because that's all it was. It was an argument from authority. And the challenge to that is very helpful to Republican legislators who want to ban this, who want to use that brute political forces. They can then appeal to the science, which, you know, the burden of proof here is on the people who want to do the experiment. And they don't have it. So yeah, there's two fronts to the battle, but they sort of relate to one another.
Yeah, I mean, about the New York Times being more open to this, they always like to print all the things that are fit to print 5 years ago, right? why do you think it is? And we'll start talking also about the free speech battle surrounding this exact same issue now in your native Scotland, right? Mm-hmm. But why has Europe and the UK, I guess, why have Europe and the UK been, the expert class has been able to backpedal on this in a way that has not really happened yet so far as I can observe in America? Like, what's happened actually is a lot of these associations have dug in more. They've become more political, not less. And whereas, as you say, these, you know, secular, generally, you know, not associated with conservative forces, these kinds of medical sort of associations in the UK and in Europe, they seem like they have been able, at least at bare minimum, to look at the evidence. Now, I don't know that that's enough to build a sane society. Like, you really shouldn't have to amass evidence for the concept that cutting off a 15-year-old's penis is not, like, a healthy medical protocol.
Right.
So it doesn't get you all the way there, but nevertheless, it seems like, and I sort of noticed the same thing with COVID, actually, like that America was more split on COVID. There was a lot more freedom in red states than in a lot of European countries. But especially on some of the vaccine stuff, once it became clear that COVID was spreading through the vaccinated population and stuff, there was more willingness to reconsider, quote unquote, the science, than in America, where, like, I feel like those scientific bodies that were dug in on it stayed dug in. I mean, almost to today, right, where you still have a lot of these medical bodies saying, like, time to get your fifth COVID shot, right?
Right.
Which, I don't know, what is your explanation? Because I've thought a lot about this, and I don't have, like, a clear answer as to why that is. But it seems like the expert class in Europe and the UK is often more likely, they'll go along with these ideological fads, and they don't have any sort of antibodies against them from the beginning in the sort of common sense way, but they seem more dedicated. They're not going to, like, override the actual scientific experimental protocol, looking for evidence, like the things that you would expect from secular scientists.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of things. I think the first is actually just structural. So the National Health Service is running out of money. It's, you know, it's already so difficult for people to get access to really, really timely, important things. It's going to be naturally a lot more risk averse. So if something, even take the sort of heat out of the argument, if something isn't proven to be helping a patient population and it's expensive and it's controversial and it, you know, there's all sorts of liabilities if you get it wrong, they're just going to stop doing it as a kind of pragmatic thing. So I think part of it is that. Another part of it with the NHS, so I'm talking specifically about the UK, but other European countries are comparable, is that because it's centralized and it's public, everything that it's doing is quite easy to find out. So we knew straight away the numbers that were of young people going to this main clinic, because it was one main clinic for the most part. We knew the numbers. We knew that it increased by 4,000% in a decade. Journalists were able to look at that and go, what on earth is going on here? We still don't really have a proper sense of the numbers in the United States. We know roughly how many young people identify as transgender, but we're not keeping tabs on the number of clinics. We're not keeping tabs on how many kids are coming in and out of those. And so it's less easy for people to sort of notice these trends. The other thing in the UK was the political dynamic with the gender stuff was that because we don't really have a right wing, we don't really have like a right wing political party. I mean, I know we do nominally, but we don't really have a culture war. The divides sort of became between the liberal left and the progressive left. And so it became acceptable to challenge the claims of transgender ideology, whether that was through journalism or whether that was through clinicians speaking out, and not be immediately considered like a hateful bigot. I mean, I know you were painted that, but like to the public, you were still presentable. You were still within, very much within the mainstream. And then I suppose the other side of this is that there's a certain way that you expect doctors and scientists to talk, I think, in Europe. Science is supposed to be about the uncertain, right? So you're supposed to be looking for looking for things that will contradict your theory, and you're supposed to be very open-minded that might happen. It is the exact opposite of politics, done properly, right? You have a high degree of humility. You accept that you know very little, and you're trying to find out through process of elimination what what's the best thing to do in any given set of circumstances. And certainly in the UK, they fell into the public health policy trap where science, politics masquerading as science was given to the public in order to basically control them because nobody actually knew what was going on with the pandemic. But you're right, it was sort of out of character. And in the fullness of time, people start to go, wait, we don't know what we're doing here. And so I think that the way that even the clinical, the sort of people who have bought into the transgender ideology at that main gender youth clinic, the way they talk, I mean, they accept such a thing as being transgender, and they accept this nonsensical notion that you can change sex, and they are subscribed to that in lots of ways, but they don't talk like the fanatics in the United States. They don't talk like the gender clinicians in the United States. They're very much like,
you know, TikTok accounts about yeeting the teeth.
Yeah, that you really would not find that in the UK. It's they talk like a normal doctor, except that they're, you know, obviously saying things that are wildly wrong. But they'll weigh up risks and benefits, and they'll claim to be. I remember interviewing a clinician who does believe there's such a thing as being transgender and thinks he's helping people, and at this gender youth clinic in Britain, and he was telling me, oh no, we're very conservative, and he does not mean politically conservative, he means medically conservative. You know, we're very cautious, we take our time, we make sure we understand where the patients come through. That's not true, but at least that's like the default setting. I think Americans are, it's the Wild West. You can go set up shop, you can promise the moon, and nobody's going to stop you. And even think of this in things of like, why is cosmetic surgery so much bigger in the US than it is in Europe? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. But I think it's obviously in part the demand, I understand. But it is also in part like the marketing that goes into it.
Yeah, and the taste difference, frankly. The taste difference. You know, it's certainly true. When you were talking, I found myself wondering if like really skeptical scientific medicine can really be practiced in American culture. Like, ever, forgetting about this particular issue that's obviously linked to larger moral questions, to politics, you know, we do have that. We have a consumer model of medicine, which mm-hmm. has enormous upsides. And you would know those upsides if you are in a socialized medicine country and you have something like, you know, stage 3 cancer. People with money come to the United States to have that treated for the mm-hmm. most part, right? If they're able, they come to the United States. We have the best state-of-the-art treatments. We have the best survival rates for various terrible cancers, heart disease, et cetera, right? So there are enormous, and of course, a large percentage of the development of drugs happens in the United States because it's very profitable to do that. So all that innovation has enormous upsides. So I'm not downplaying it, but there is also this consumer mentality around medicine where it's like the customer is always right. And if the customer is a, you know, 15-year-old who says that they don't want their breasts anymore, then, you know, it goes in that direction kind of naturally for the system. And I don't know that it's like when you were describing the lobbying process and of American medical associations, I found myself wondering how out of the norm that actually is. In the American medical system as opposed to the European one. But, you know, aside from the larger questions about the medical system, which I'm totally not an expert on, I was thinking also about the limits of the boundaries of politics over this in the UK, which have been sort of superficially more successful, I think, than mm-hmm. the United States, right? You have, as we've been discussing, you have more actual institutional pushback. Mm-hmm. You have more like serious medical safeguards on this. And actually I was thinking about when I was in Glasgow for your wedding, Maddie, which was a really interesting experience because right across from my hotel was this huge rally in Glasgow. And you had, on the one hand, you had the like sort of pro-trans people. And on the other hand, you had the TERFs. And as you said, like those were the two sides. There's not really a conservative side of that mm-hmm. battle. It was, you know, sort of the old left versus the new left. And one of the women on the TERF side had this sign. It said, your mom's a TERF, right? And actually, that struck me as exactly the dynamic of the debate, which was essentially an older generation of the left upset at the direction that the younger generation had taken, had imbibed all of the ideas in the home or from the larger culture, right? But in this case, like it often looked literally like mothers against their daughters, right? Mm-hmm. Had imbibed a lot of the ideas of the old left, had taken them to a logical conclusion that then made the old left people start backpedaling.
Yeah.
Saying, wait a minute, we didn't mean that. And so I wonder, even though there's a lot of people, I think, even in the US that look with envy at what the TERFs have accomplished. And to be clear, I mean, IW works with a lot of TERF organizations. We have partnered with them. Like, I think, and also I have a real appreciation for what they're going through, because I think unlike conservatives came in some sense pre-canceled in that conservative, especially social conservative thought, has been so balkanized from a lot of the both social and professional networks in the US that conservatives had to build their own infrastructure, right? We have think tanks instead of universities on the right, for example.
Yeah.
And so what's happening now is those brave feminists who are starting to talk about this and speaking up very loudly about it, they're still very attached to all the networks of the left, right? Their friends mm-hmm. are left-wing. They're working at universities where the prevailing political winds are against them. And so this is my critique is not to downplay sort of the bravery of being in that position and deciding that, you know, this quixotic quest to change sex is not true. It's damaging. You see it as dangerous. And then to speak about it, you get the kind of blowback that I think even conservatives just don't get, because mm-hmm. apostate, right? You're apostatizing from your own tribe. And that's always a really difficult experience, right? So all that sort of positive thing aside, I'm not sure I'd trade our dynamic in the US for that one, because it also seems like there's no actual possibility of victory. And it really felt at that rally like the last gasp of a generational turnover that didn't have the vigorousness that sort of still had its connections to the establishment and therefore had certain victories associated with that. But I don't know. Something about it to me felt very inevitable in a way that when we're talking about the state laws in the United States, like the outcome of that battle doesn't seem inevitable to me in the same way.
Well, I think that, I mean, they have made like a lot of progress, but you're right. Like it is the David and Goliath fight. I mean, I think the success of their efforts is going to depend on whether they can bring the Conservative Party along with them. Now, they have actually made it so that like Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, would probably be very happy for this Conservative government to do as much as it possibly can to hold the line on laws and policies that uphold biological reality. Say, for instance, school guidance to schools. That's one thing that the TERFs have been really fighting for. And I think Keir Starmer knows what a woman is, really doesn't want this fight, it's not what he wants to be talking about. It's not what he wants to be asked about. And if the Conservatives were to hold the line and then he were to get in the next election, I don't think he'd touch it. I don't think he'd try and change it. And I think that would be a major win for the TERFs to have worked with the politicians they could work with to get something that's difficult to undo. It's not impossible to undo. Another government could undo it. But just to hold the line, they're basically in a in an exercise of damage control, right? Because they can't undo many of these advances. For instance, there's a piece of legislation called the Equality Act. This is the UK Equality Act. It was in 2010. And what they're having to do is they're having to fight for the protected, there's various protected characteristics in this legislation. One of them is sex. And so they're appealing to the current anti-discrimination legislation as a way of stopping further encroachments against their rights. So, for example, the Maya Verstappen case, this was the woman who was fired for stating quite politely that she believes in there's two sexes and sex is immutable. This is the woman that J.K. Rowling originally got into the fight defending. That set precedent in the UK, very important precedent, that people could not be fired for stating that, because that belief is protected under the UK Equality Act's protected characteristic of belief, philosophical belief. Now, a better system would be, you can say what you like because it's a free country and you shouldn't be fired for saying something, you know, certainly shouldn't be fired for jobs in the public sector for saying something like just basic. But the framework was already in place that they have to appeal to the last thing. You know, the last thing they can hang on to is that discrimination on the basis of sex or discrimination on the basis of protected characteristics. So that's the language they use. They say, well, according to the law of the land, this is a protected belief and therefore I can say it. When really, you know, if you take the hard line tariff, somebody like Kelly J. Keene, she'll say it's not a belief. It's an observation of reality. It's not my philosophical belief that you can't change sex. I don't need a law to tell me that. It's just true. It's just basic truth that's knowable and observable. So you're right. Like they're starting, I think, especially in terms of the amount of freedom that Americans enjoy versus their British counterparts. They're on much more wobbly ground, the Brits, in protecting these freedoms. And yeah, these wins are still important and the fight is still important. And, you know, for as long as it's possible to hold on, they should, because people's lives are being helped by precedents like the Maya Verstappen case. But yeah, I take your point that you wouldn't trade where we are with where they are.
You know what it really reminds me of, just as an analogy, we have something in the U.S. called the Administrative Procedure Act, right, that governs regulatory pronouncements from bureaucratic agencies in the federal government. And it is an attempt to substitute and recognize that agencies were putting out, now we have a problem with, you know, not even regulatory behavior, but things like Dear Colleague letters that go around this. So, like, of course, the agencies have sort of molded themselves around this legislation. But this is from the late 1940s, I believe, in the United States. And it's at once a recognition of the reality, which is that agency power even then was well out of control and needed some guidelines that, you know, we need a procedure for these kinds of bureaucratic pronouncements, for these regulations that we're promulgating. We need some sort of ability to have an input on what they are, right? So the APA essentially provides one notice and comment period where, if you're paying attention, if you're a small percentage of people who are watching what the federal agencies are doing, you can put in a comment. IW does that pretty regularly, right? We comment on things like Title IX or whatever else. So if you're kind of an interested party, you often are following these things, you can comment. Then, you know, the agency has to respond to all of the arguments. So, and then everybody goes to court to determine whether the agency answers were adequate to the questions that were raised and the points that were raised by the interested parties, right? Mm-hmm. And this is better than nothing if you think about out of control agency power. It's also a complete sort of administrative farce when you think about the way that law is supposed to be made, right? We're supposed mm-hmm. to have a discussion in public as free people vote elected representatives into office who then in public debate what law, like what language then becomes a law, right? And then it goes to the other branch of the government, the governor or the president, right? And if you think of the APA safeguards as kind of this pale facsimile of what actual representative self-government is supposed to look like, all of a sudden it looks very weak. And that's kind of what I think about when I see that kind of dynamic, like in the UK, is it's reinforced by this current battle that you've alluded to. Maybe we'll drill down a little bit more on, which is obviously there are not the same kind of First Amendment, like free speech guarantees in the UK as there are in the US. There never have been. There's always been the law developed quite differently in the UK versus the US. The legal regime in the UK permits the kind of regulation of speech by the government that is a complete non-starter in the United States, even as degraded as we are, and all the problems that we have with this sort of private regulation of speech and all kinds of things. One problem we do not yet have is a law that says this is hate speech, it's illegal, we're going to put you in prison. So what is going on with some of these turf battles and the gender ideology battles? And like, so JK Rowling is saying she's ready to go to prison. Like, what's going on in Scotland?
Okay, so in 2020, the Scottish National Party, under then First Minister Nicola Sturgeon and then Justice Secretary Humza Yousaf, who is now the First Minister, introduced a law called the Hate Crime and Public Order Act. And actually, when this was first introduced, when it was first introduced, this was met with praise from the Humanist Society of Scotland and other sort of secular organizations. Why? Because it was promoted as a repeal of a dormant blasphemy law. So this is a blasphemy law from 1837, which had not been used to prosecute anybody in over 150 years. But nevertheless, you know, this is a great symbol. We should repeal this dormant blasphemy law to show that we're a post-Christian society. That was the thinking, and sounds great, doesn't it? Well, except for the fact that in the same law that they repealed this 1837 blasphemy law, they basically enshrined a whole new blasphemy law. It is now illegal under this law to stir up hatred against a protected identity group. And these identity groups include religion, they include sexual orientation, transgender identity, not race, because that's covered in a separate law, and notably not sex, because that's going to be addressed later, so they say. And so what are the criteria to know if you've stirred up hatred? Well, it has to be found threatening, abusive, or insulting by a reasonable person. What's a reasonable person? I don't know. Okay. And to add to the insanity of this, there doesn't have to be a specific victim. So for instance, I could say something rude about a group, one of these groups. I could say something rude about gay people. Let's say I was a comedian, for instance, at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and I made a joke about gays. That might be found offensive, abusive, threatening, or insulting by somebody in the audience who's not even gay, okay, who could then report me, and that would be stirring up hatred potentially. So to add to just the like absolute optics of this, there are third party reporting sites across Scotland. One of them is a salmon and trout wholesaler in Berwickshire. So if you're feeling like telling on one of your neighbours, you can go to this salmon and trout wholesaler. Another is a sex shop in Glasgow. I'm not making this up. Okay. These are the third-party reporting sites where you can go.
I was going to say that's a new meaning to the phrase interfering trout, which I believe your people use.
Seriously. I mean, yeah. But So anyway, and then the police have to arbitrate. Now this, when this was suggested, because it's taken 3 years to go from this law being passed. It was passed in April 2021, and it's only coming into effect now. Why? Because when this first happened, Scottish Police Federation, which represents like 98% of police in Scotland, said this is going to be very difficult to enforce. It's going to require policing what people think and feel. It's too vague. We don't have examples. In fact, one minister said that the meeting to develop the guidance for the police officers deliberately avoided using real life examples of a gender critical feminist and a transgender person because it would upset the transgender lobby. So there's no saying exactly how this is to be applied. And so it has an absolutely chilling effect on most people's speech. Now, J.K. Rowling, who lives in Scotland, wanted to make a point because, you know, she has a lot of money and she has a lot of name recognition. So she, on the day that this law came into effect, April 1st, April Fool's Day, you know, what a great day to make Scotland the laughingstock of the world. She had a series of tweets calling self-identified transgender women men, and some of these men were convicted criminals. She drew attention to the case of the guy who was convicted of rape, twice convicted rapist, who identified as a woman in an effort to be sent to a woman's prison. Obviously a bad idea. Anyway, she called him a man, she called a bunch of other people a man, and she basically said, come get me. Okay, like if this is a violation of the law, like come get me. Now the police, there is a story from a couple of hours ago, the police apparently released a statement saying that while they had received complaints about J.K. Rowling under the law for these tweets, they had ascertained that they did not rise to the level of criminal, and so they would be taking no further action. To which J.K. Rowling replied, well, that's reassuring. I trust that this will be the same for women with less name recognition and less financial resources. I trust you'll be applying the law equally. But it's impossible to apply because it's so subjective. The whole thing is so subjective. It's like the idea that there would be like a, you know, a sex shop in New York that you go to and the police could then show up at somebody's door and tell them off for saying something potentially rude. It's just, yeah, it's not something, it's unthinkable. It's unthinkable to Americans, is it not?
I mean, it's unthinkable. I could see New York trying. I mean, we do have SOGI laws in some states, which, you know, enshrine gender identity as a protected category. But the difference is, there is always a backstop of the First Amendment in the United States. Now, we can engage in all kinds of other kinds of tyranny, but the First Amendment will protect you from being jailed for saying things, particularly true things, right? You can, it protects false statements as well in a lot of contexts, but more context than the UK. You guys also have much stricter libel laws than are possible in the United States under the First Amendment. But you know, it really has made me appreciate Madison and putting in these, because there was a big debate in the United States, right, about whether putting in the Bill of Rights was actually a bad idea, because it would give the impression that these are little islands of liberty, when in fact the restrictions in the Constitution are supposed to restrain the government in all circumstances, instead of what is expressly allowed to it, right? That obviously, as a ship that sailed a long time ago, and I find myself very grateful for these islands of liberty, right? So I think it kind of puts a point in Madison's favor in those debates over the anti-federalists and over those who did not think that, or sorry, over the federalists and those who did not think that, you know, we needed to expressly and in a limited way enumerate the kind of rights of the people, because that's really what has happened, right? We have shrunk down the notion of liberty in the United States to this little island of the First Amendment. But that being said, it's a nice place to put your toes in the ocean, right? So, I don't know. Let's close with talking about this. Over and over again in a lot of this like entire dynamic between sort of the experts and people speaking up and you know, the political and the sort of administrative and all of these different roles, it does seem like we're fighting on a turf that is, and I didn't mean that as a pun, but it is a little bit. We are fighting on a turf that is fundamentally hostile to claims of truth. Mm. I noticed when you were talking about the two wings of sort of the turf activism, that essentially one is the retreat into, well, I'm thinking like conscientious objectors in the Vietnam War, right? Mm-hmm. This is my faith. And therefore it's protected, or RFRA in the United States, right? This is my religious faith, therefore it has mm-hmm. special protections and you kind of can't cross this line. But that's actually, again, like the APA, that's sort of a shoring up of something that has already been lost. It's like building a different scaffolding for things that you have through small t tradition mm-hmm. and don't want to let go of while letting the essence of what that thing is, right? The purpose of free speech in America is to be able to get to the truth. That's mm-hmm. why false speech is only incidentally protected. False speech is protected because we don't trust the government to determine mm-hmm. the truth or falsity of speech, not because the point is to allow people to lie with impunity in the public square, mm-hmm. right? And we've lost that. Same thing with like even obscenity protection, right? There's still this category of obscenity that's not protected. There's virtually nothing but child porn left in that category legally, and everything else that the founders and people until 1956 would have considered obviously obscene and well within the democratic sphere to ban or not ban. Those, like, virtually every piece of that is protected. Mm-hmm. And again, even the rationale there is, we don't want the government deciding between the smutty parts of Ulysses and, right, and pornography. We don't trust the government to make that distinction. Okay, so we are just having this very broad protection. There are advantages to that. There are disadvantages. Okay. But it really seems like the secular world of liberty cannot stand for long without some kind of normative assertion of truth underneath it. And I'm thinking about this because of something you sent me when we were discussing what we wanted to talk about today on the podcast. And that's Richard Dawkins coming out and basically saying, I'm a cultural Christian. This is, to some extent, always been true about the new atheists. Certainly, I think Christopher Hitchens would have acknowledged that debt and did acknowledge that debt many times. But he was sort of the best of the new atheists in many ways. But now we have somebody like Richard Dawkins acknowledging that, in fact, there are things that are worse than cultural Christianity in the West. And it seems like there's an entire large swath of people. I often on this podcast call them 90s liberals. I think the IDW mm-hmm. largely fits into this category. I think TERFs in the UK fit into this category. Who kind of want to retain the flowers without the water. Yeah. Right. They want cut flowers in a vase forever. And they are coming to the realization, many of them, that it's very difficult to maintain the freedoms that they actually do value in the face of either like the complete fading away of Christianity, the rise of what one might call a religion like wokeism, or at least something with religious fervor that has moral content and assertions that are not easily challenged on the basis of fact, right? Something like racism exists everywhere in the United States and it has all these effects. And even though you can't see it, it's microaggressions and, right? Anyway, that's a lot of things to throw into lead up to a question. But, you know, what do you think is the fate? Because it seems in many ways that the fate of the West is kind of with this turfy, like you and I are, I mean, as much as I think we're right, you know, we are outliers, even among people. Like, I think we would feel very comfortable just asserting, okay, this is a matter of truth. men and women. This is not, which is why we feel the same way about it largely after 18 as before 18. We don't see it as, and I don't want to speak for you, maybe you do, but I don't see it as like some great divide. Yes, it's worse to do these things to a 15-year-old because the 15-year-old has less ability to form, you know, good desires than the 18-year-old or the 20-year-old or the 30-year-old. But like, I still think it's a terrible thing to remove a 35-year-old woman's healthy breasts on the basis of a lie, right? So what do you think our fate is? Because it seems like as a society, we do shake down somewhere in this Dawkins, particularly sort of the professional classes of society, like in this Dawkins turf, like sort of category where we might win some battles in some way when the progressive left goes, or what you call the progressive left, goes way too far. But like, it just seems like there is nothing deeper to reach for under it. It's just, we like free speech because we like it. Mm-hmm. Not, this is a tradition deeply rooted in a Christian civilization.
Yeah.
That has all these like, you know, antecedents in both philosophy and theology. We can get rid of all of that, but we can keep the fact that we just kind of like free speech and that's how we do it.
Mm-hmm. Or even in some people's cases, we like free speech because it's our free speech that's under threat, right? We don't necessarily feel that strongly about it when it's people we disagree with who are dealing with the consequences of encroachments on free speech. I mean, you're right. The I think it was Tom Holland who wrote Dominion, this book, kind of making the case that a lot of the secular moral norms that we take for granted, be it, you know, freedom of conscience or freedom of speech or even human rights, have
a fundamental childhood.
Yeah,
that's certainly something that didn't exist in the ancient world, in the pagan world.
Yeah, all of these
scriptures against infanticide.
Yeah, these have Christian or Judeo-Christian origins, and that we deliberately undermine those origins at our peril. And in fact, he described the Richard Dawkins interview you're talking about as somebody who's been sawing at a branch they're sitting on and looking nervously at the ground, which is, I think, kind of the perfect image. Richard Dawkins is somebody who's done everything in his power to undermine Christianity and the practice of Christianity. And he, even to this day, thinks that the fact that less and less people believe is a good thing. But of course, you know, what happens to an organism when its root is killed? Like, it dies, the whole thing dies, and nature abhors a vacuum, and we're living in a religious time. It's just different religions. In Europe, you have Islam that's filling the void, and you also have the religion of woke and social progressivism and all that entails. And I think of the truth, the issue of the truth, a lot with the transgender issue, because I think that the people who have really advanced the ball here, whether in the UK or in the US, are not simply the people who've tried to make the argument transgenderism is harmful. It's people who complete the sentence. Transgenderism is harmful because it isn't true. That's why it's harmful. It's harmful because you can't change your sex. And so an attempt to change your sex is futile, and your body will rebel against it. And when you inflict wounds and have to dilate wounds and treat them, your body will scream in agony because it's not meant to do that. It's not evolved to do that. And the same can be true. You know, I think you're absolutely right to say that, okay, yes, it's worse to do this to a child because the child is so vulnerable and so incapable of consenting. But it's also wrong to do this to the adult because it's not true, because it's not going to help, because the evidence is not there to support them. So, yeah, I mean, this is the difficulty about a culture that has only the most superficial understanding of rights and of harms and conflicting rights, and not actually understanding that true freedom is freedom to act in accordance with what is true, with with reality. A person who is free to set themselves on fire is not really living an authentically free choice if they proceed to do that. As for how we get out of this, I mean, I kind of share your pessimism, honestly. I mean, this is a minority view that this is this important, and this is the way that we should frame these public arguments. Most people just have this superficial libertarian focus on harms, and obviously the transgender issue has violated those in some very obvious ways. But to be consistent, you have to complete the sentence.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. My way of putting it that I've been repeating, and I like the branch analogy as well, but with regard to a certain kind of libertinism, because I don't even think it's libertarian, the part of libertarianism that I find negative influence on the right is not sort of small L libertarianism, leave me alone kind of attitude. In many ways, I think that's a folk way in the United States, and has been around for a long time. But when it prevents the right, like sort of self prevents, because in the 1960s, sometime it gave up on the legitimacy of using political power about anything that could be personal or moral. Right. Of course, the left doesn't feel that way and uses political power in those questions all the time. And to me, the question of legitimacy is whose political power, right? The question of self-government versus, you know, government by unelected bureaucrats or whoever else. But that's sort of the pernicious influence of libertarianism to me. But there's a certain type of libertinism that comes out of the 90s. And I think it is very much, and not coincidentally, 90s and 2000s is when the new atheist movement, I think, was having the most impact on, I don't know, the intellectual life of the nation, and also, I think, in Europe. This idea that, like, we can shed the superstitious past, we can move into this very, like, capital S science-based future. And it turns out that a lot of the ambitions, I mean, it seemed to work for a while. Is the thing, right? And the metaphor that I've been using is of a ball, you know, going up in the air and then coming down, right? It falls in a parabola if you throw it up in the air, and then taking a photo of it at the top and saying, well, see, we don't, you know, the ball stays up. And there's such, and I think this video is of Richard Dawkins is such a good demonstration. And the collapse of new atheism in terms of explanatory power about the world, from now, you know, from, I don't know, 2003 to now, it seems very much like that to me, that you take a moment in time and stand on the shoulders of, you know, millennia of philosophical development and national development and all kinds of norms that are developed, and then say, well, from this precipice, we can continue to accelerate. Let's just get rid of the dead weight. And I don't know, there is this like inevitable falling to earth. There seems to be this inevitable resurgence of perhaps what the Islamic world was already experiencing in the 80s. You know, there was a good bit of the 20th century where the Middle East was not full of religious fanatics. Go back and look at those pictures in Iran, right, from the 1960s and 70s. You'll see, like, before the revolution. So maybe they got there in some way first, although that's not a tradition I'd want to emulate.
Yeah.
but we are now experiencing it. And it seems really, this video from Dawkins seems really hopeless to me. It's like he will never actually accept that the things that supported the things that he want, like your analogy from the guy that you were referencing, the things that support the things that he wants in the world are not compatible with the way, with his truth commitments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they actually, to stay on Dawkins, it's concerning that he seems actually intimidated to say what he really thinks about Islam. I'm sure that, I think he's friends with Salman Rushdie, and I'm sure what happened to him is frightening to him, and it would be frightening to me as well. and I'm sure he's been threatened. But he said in a number of interviews, there was an interview he did with Piers Morgan where he said, Piers Morgan asked him about his views on Islam, and he said, I don't want to discuss it. I just don't want to discuss it. And Piers Morgan pressed and said, that's kind of disturbing from a free speech perspective. He was like, no. And the same thing in this interview where he described himself as a cultural Christian, he said, I have to be careful what I say here, but I think that Christianity is a fundamentally decent religion in a way that Islam's not. And then that was it. That was as far as he would go, and he wouldn't explain much more about what he meant. And I think it's because for that reason that, you know, part of why what's meant by conservatism is this appreciation that the good things that we enjoy did not come from nowhere. They're not a given. They're hard won, and the result of a long bloody past that's arrived at where we are, and it's important to protect. It's important to be grateful. And I think that the new atheism movement was just the antithesis of like the young. I mean, I know they weren't particularly young, but like it was just that sort of teenage rebellion where, you know, let's say F you to mom and dad and everything they've given us. But then in the fullness of time, with some maturity and confronting the alternatives, realizing that actually it's a pretty good deal. Of course, he's just like maybe he genuinely doesn't connect the dots, or maybe he just doesn't have the humility to say, I got this really wrong. Forget what I said. Don't buy my book. I mean, nobody ever says that, do they? But I mean, that would be the responsible thing to do here, to be honest.
Well, on that note, thanks again, Maddie Kearns, for coming on High Noon. You can find Maddie's work over at actually, it's Madeline, right? For purposes of writing.
Yeah. Well, if you want Madeline Kearns for my archives, it would be you're going to find me under Madeline, but. You may call me Maddie, Inez.
Yes. So you can find her work over at National Review. You can also find the policy focus that she's written about the gender transition laws in all these states and these various medical bodies on our website on IWF.org. Thanks again for coming, Maddie.
Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners. High Noon with Inez Stepan is a production of the Independent Women's Forum. As always, you can send comments and questions to Inez Stepan at IWF.org. Please help us out by hitting the subscribe button and leaving us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts, Acast, Google Play, YouTube, or IWF.org. Be brave, and we'll see you next time on High Noon.